Welcome to Nepal Now. My name is Marty Logan. Looking back on the early days of my relationship with Nepal, I see that it took me far too long to realize that this is a country of incredible diversity of cultures and peoples. Today I can understand why. The face of Nepal is very much upper caste, Hindu, male, and Nepali speaking. Yet roughly a third of the country's nearly 30 million people belong to about 100 indigenous groups, 60 of them officially recognized. Surprisingly, you hear very little about these groups on a day-to-day basis, especially compared to countries like Canada or Australia, where the proportion of indigenous people is much lower, but where indigenous rights is a major talking point and issue. When I moved to Nepal just before the end of the 10-year Maoist conflict in 2005, a lot of heat was being generated in discussions over the rebels' proposal to divide the country based on the territories of the major indigenous groups. In the end, that vision was not realized, and people like today's guest, indigenous activist Prabin Shakya, argue that the Maoists were playing with the aspirations of many marginalized people in the country simply to attain their political ends. Since the peace process ended, Indigenous rights is a topic that is highlighted in mainstream media annually on Indigenous People's Day, then fades away. Those of us living in Kathmandu do hear regularly about disputes over development projects that threaten the lands of the Newa or Nuar, Indigenous people of the Kathmandu Valley, but these are rarely framed as Indigenous rights issues. Shakya tells me that a lot of activism is happening. Yes, much of it is in reaction to government plans to take over Indigenous people's lands in the name of development. But some proactive initiatives to recognize Indigenous rights are taking place at local levels. Learn more now in my conversation with Prabin Shakya. Prabin Shakya, welcome to Nepal Now.
Jozalapa Martin, namaste. Good afternoon. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, that was great. So I think that was hello in three languages: English, Nepali, and
Nepal Bhasa.
Nepal Bhasa, right? Which I have always called Nuar, but I'm seeing it more often and hearing it more often called Nepal Bhasa, which is an interesting conversation about language that maybe we can get into later on or another time. But for now, let's start talking about, well, one of the reasons we're talking today in particular is because next week, I think you told me you're busy with a study tour concerning a proposed government of Nepal project that's called the Chobar Dry Port. If I understand correctly, what's happened is that some residents living nearby are upset about the planned project because it impinges on their land, and they've made a complaint to one of the funders, the World Bank, and somehow you, as an Indigenous rights activist and advocate, are involved. So maybe you can tell me a little bit of background on that.
So yeah, this is a representative case of how Indigenous rights in Nepal are violated in the name of development. The project, as you said, it's a Chobar Dry Port, is part of government's plan to have this North-South corridor between India and China, with Nepal as one of the former prime ministers, Baburam Bhattarai, called to transform Nepal into a vibrant bridge between India and China. So basically, they are building these expressways, transmission lines to facilitate trade with India and China, and between India and China through Nepal. No? So yes, the dry port is being built with the financing of the World Bank. It is the only funder, actually, and Nepal government is also putting in some money. It's not just some residents, but a lot of residents in Quena. That's how the local area is known in Nepal Bhasa. In Quena are not happy with the construction of the dry port. Many reasons. Yeah, one of the reasons is that the area where the dry port is being built or has been built used to be Himal Cement Factory. So the land was acquired for the construction of the Himal Cement Factory. The cement factory was closed. It operated for a couple of decades, I think, in the 70s, 80s. It was closed particularly because of the mismanagement of the government, as is common with many government owned enterprises in Nepal, but also because of the local opposition and opposition across Kathmandu for the air pollution that the Himal cement factory was causing. The cement factory was located in an area in Chobar, which is basically a gorge. The Chobar Gorge is connected to the myth of the origin of Kathmandu Valley. It is believed that Kathmandu Valley in prehistoric times was a lake, a big lake, and Manjushri, a deity as Newar people considered him, cut off Chobar Valley to start the settlement, which is what it is now. No? So that is basically the only air outlet as well as the outlet for the holy Bagmati River from Kathmandu Valley. As per the land law, Land Acquisition Act of Nepal, if the original purpose of acquisition is exhausted, does not apply anymore, then the land should be returned back to the original land owners, you know. But that did not happen. The government, as we consider it, is a land usurper, land mafia, a land realtor, does not want to return back after it has acquired a piece of land. So immediately after the Himal cement factory was closed, at one time it wanted to auction off the land. The original land owners protested and also filed a petition at the court. The court ruled in favor of the land owners. But again, the government did not want to implement that. It even appealed against the court judgment to the higher court. The higher court sustained the judgment of the lower court. But still, the government at times brought in the plan of establishing a squatter settlement there. Sometimes they brought in the plan of waste treatment plant there. All of those plans were opposed. And more recently, the government has now transferred the land to the Nepal Intermodal Development Committee, which is building the dry port with the assistance of the World Bank. The locals even protested when the foundation stone for the dry port was laid by then Prime Minister K.P. Sharma Oli. More than 80 locals were detained for a day. The World Bank had even suspended financing because of these grievances and among other grievances. But then the government established this sham grievance procedure, basically ignored all of the grievances that the local residents had made, and has gone on with the construction. So that is why the local affected communities, which are predominantly Newar people, have filed a complaint with the World Bank. And next week, the inspection panel, which is an independent accountability mechanism of the World Bank, is undertaking a fact-finding mission to see if the complaint filed requires further investigation.
Okay, great. Thanks for that good explanation. I'm really happy that you also mentioned the origin story of Kathmandu Valley and the Chobar Gorge, because it's one I've heard a few times since I've been living here. Mm-hmm. And I know it's really important. And it also brings out this aspect of the Newar community being the original inhabitants of Kathmandu Valley. So there's another site, again, outside of Kathmandu called Kokana, mm-hmm. which has also been in the news often in recent years, because it's going to be affected by a large number of big development projects. And I think one of the biggest is this so-called fast track highway from Kathmandu down to the main existing east-west highway, which is the only one that runs the length of the country. And so that highway is very close to being under construction, and it will cut through this Kokana area. There have been many protests. I mean, would you say that in terms of indigenous activism that's happening in Nepal these days, is most of it of a similar nature where you have these development projects planned? They seem to go ahead without a lot of consultation, certainly without agreement of indigenous groups. And then these protests ensue, and then we have these struggles that are going on now, like in Chobar and Kokana.
That's very correct. I mean, with regards to indigenous activism, I think, the history of Nepal is filled with rebellions by ethnic groups who were kind of suppressed since the time of the Gurkha conquest, no, that led to the formation of the modern Nepal state. There are various academic books, reports that have documented this very well, how various ethnic groups, including Newar people, have rebelled against the state because the state, the formation of the state has come at the cost of denying the existence or denying the identities, the distinct identities of these groups. The indigenous activism now, there's also a side to it where it is a lot of political activism. Representatives or indigenous community leaders are trying to seek their due participation in the political processes, which has become more prominent since the opening of the democratic process in Nepal in the 1990s. But what I am involved in as an indigenous rights activist is activism for land and resource rights of indigenous communities. And I try to support these communities. So yeah, the Newar communities in Kokana, I would also add Bungamati there, Kokana and Bungamati. These are two historical settlements of Newar people in the south of Kathmandu. The other community that I was talking about in Kuena, in Chobar, is just across Bagmati River. So again, these three communities are quite close to each other. And as I was saying earlier, the Chobar Dry Port, this expressway, these are all plans of the government to connect, to expedite trade, to facilitate trade through Nepal. No? So the expressway connects with the dry port. The expressway, as you said, connects in the south of Nepal with the east-west highway and then to India. Then again, through Kathmandu, they are expanding or they are constructing multiple highways to China so that, you know, there is more trade in Nepal. We believe it is important for the prosperity, financial prosperity, I would say, of Nepal to implement these projects. But then again, it should not come at the cost of indigenous peoples being dispossessed of their lands and resources, because again, through the history of formation of modern Nepal state, we have been dispossessed of a lot of our lands and resources, and as a result, our meaningful participation in the political as well as the governance processes of Nepal. No? Coming back to Kokana, the issue here stems from the lack of consultation and meaningful consultation, I would say, and then non-respect or ignorance or neglect of the requirement to obtain the free, prior, and informed consent of the affected indigenous communities as required by international laws that are applicable to Nepal. No? Nepal has adopted or has signed on to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and also ratified the Indigenous and Tribal Peoples Convention of the International Labour Organization that requires Nepal to obtain the state to obtain free, prior, and informed consent when there is any development project or other measures that are affecting the communities, indigenous communities, particularly when there is relocation of indigenous communities from their lands. In the EIA report itself, the report of the environmental impact assessment itself, it is clearly noted that there was significant objection from the communities in Kokana regarding the project, regarding constructing the expressway in their area. And the consultants who did the EIA also suggested other alternative alignments. But, you know, of course, the government did not respect any of those suggestions and is seeming hell-bent to basically destroy these remaining open green spaces in Kathmandu Valley in the name of constructing an expressway, which might not even be financially viable, as has been pointed in the EIA report itself too. The issue is not just about lack of respect or lack of respect for the free, prior, informed consent. The issue is also about how the government views development itself. You know, as I said earlier, this Kokana and Bungamati area are the last remaining green spaces, at least in Lalitpur, the district south of Kathmandu, which I am native to, and also very big source of agricultural produce that is required for, let's say, our food sovereignty or food independence. A lot of food and grains that we consume is now being imported from India, from China. But so instead of promoting farmers to continue their farming or even improve their farming occupation, the government is trying to displace these farmers from their lands with meager compensation or like no compensation at all. When I say no compensation at all, it is with regards to the Guti lands. So Gutis are our traditional institutions, governance institutions, whereby a land endowment is provided to continue a social or cultural ritual or to for the maintenance of a temple. No, in Bungamati, the expressway will run through a lot of Guti lands belonging to Rato Bungadia, Rato Machindranath. This is the longest running chariot festival in the world and also a source of identity for people from Patan. No? The Guti lands or the tenants of the Guti lands have not been consulted about acquisition of their land. And, the acquisition of those Guti lands has only been discussed with Guti Corporation, which is a government body set up to look after these Guti lands. So, yeah, there are these issues about cultural impacts too, not just land impacts, as I'm trying to indicate. But then again, there are also Guti lands in Kokana, which is a town famous traditionally for producing mustard oil. It is also a historical town. The locals believe that the town was set up 10,000 years ago, even before Kathmandu itself was established. Most part of Kathmandu was still a lake, as I said earlier. The worst part here, and what makes it even more difficult for the communities, is that the government has contracted Nepal Army, that is supposed to be responsible for the defense of the state, for the construction of the expressway. I would even consider it ridiculous, because we don't believe state armies in many countries operate as a private contractor for projects, and that has also raised questions about corruption or abuse of authorities within the army. The army has set up a camp in Khudol, which is proposed as the zero point or the entry point of the fast track expressway, and army camp is set up on lands for which the landowners have not accepted the compensation yet. So yeah, all of this is happening. The people, the locals, are not feeling secure, because there's long-running history about the use of army to suppress the rebellions, as I said, as well as the movements of the people or the uprisings of the people in the past. They have submitted their complaints to all the local, all the concerned authorities, to the parliamentarians, have even filed a petition in the Supreme Court, and are even knocking the doors of various international mechanisms, including the United Nations. But then the government has basically ignored and often tries to present the local opposition as being merely an issue of compensation, while the locals have clearly said that they don't want construction of expressway in their lands. They want to keep their agricultural lands and continue on with their life. No, the locals also clearly understand that expressway, the fast track expressway, is only one of the many projects that are being proposed in Kokana and Bungamati area. Once the expressway is established, then the government also plans to start exploring construction of a railway line connecting north and south. So the railway line is also proposed along the expressway. Similarly, they are saying there will be a pipeline coming from the south to Kathmandu to import petroleum products from India. So all of these projects, if implemented, will basically completely seize any remaining land that might be left after the construction of the expressway. That is why the locals are calling for realignment of the fast track expressway. They simply demand that the entry point be shifted further south by 8 kilometers, so that the entry point can connect with other highways too that enters Kathmandu from the south, and the agricultural lands can be kept intact as well, including the cultural lands. No.
Yeah, it really sounds like a long list of possible developments that are kind of hanging over people's heads. One of the things I find interesting about this situation is that in Kathmandu Valley, as you said, a lot of the land is owned by the original inhabitants, the Nuer indigenous group. And in terms of socioeconomic status, income, that sort of thing, education, etc., the Nuers do very well within Nepal as a whole. So often you think of indigenous groups as being marginalized in many different ways in some cases. And, to put it simply, sometimes being the poorest of the poor. But certainly Nuers are not in that category at all. They're near the top of Nepal's socioeconomic standings. I'm wondering, when people are well off, at least economically, does that make it somehow more difficult to generate this consciousness about their culture and their indigenous heritage and the need to preserve things?
So yes, Marty, as you rightly pointed, Newars as a group, as a social group, have been privileged and fare well in the socioeconomic wellness indicators compared to other groups. I think the main reason is because we have been fortunate, or I would say maybe even unfortunate. Basically, we have been the natives, or like the residents of Kathmandu Valley and surrounding areas, which became the capital of the modern of modern Nepal. But I think I would say that also the roots of that wellness is well-being is also the history of Newar people. No, Newar, let's say as a nation, was always rich. No, we were the bridge between traders of Tibet and India. We are, as a people, made the best of our location in this geostrategic valley since historic times. Again, the main point here being that Newar people was a nation that had been prosperous even before the formation of the modern Nepal, modern state. I think we were better off during the Malla and Lichavi era because our ancestors were building these temples, these settlements. But I think a lot of our lands in a lot of land in Kathmandu does not belong to Newar people anymore. It belongs a lot of our lands, particularly communal lands, now belong to the state legally. As per Nepal's law, though as per international law, it should belong to the communities. Here I'm trying to refer to our Guti lands, but in particular, which has been now transferred under the ownership of Guti Corporation, a corporation which does not reflect our aspirations about how Gutis should be understood and run. But at the same time, Newar people, though we have had good socioeconomic indicators, have not been progressing proportionately. Newars are like 6% of the population, but then we don't make up like around 6% of, let's say, political positions or bureaucratic positions. Our language is not even recognized by all local governments in Kathmandu Valley, where it should have been. We have become a minority within our traditional domain. Like in Kathmandu, the metropolitan area, it's only 24% Newars now, while the three quarters is now non-Newars. We are not against migration, but we are definitely against uncontrolled and unmanaged urbanization that has made Kathmandu to an extent unlivable, because every year we are seeing that the pollution level in Kathmandu Valley has been increasing. It affects our health. Also, the greater threat is on our culture and language, because the dominant language that has presented a great threat to our language, because Newar, as I said earlier, was a nation that was bound together by language. Among Newar nation, there were Hindus, there were Buddhists, there were even Christians and Muslims. There were farmers, there were traders, but all of us were bound together because of the common use of language and similarities in culture, but that is slowly fading away. Newars, having good socioeconomic indicators, have made it difficult, but also easier to bring this indigenous consciousness among Newars. I have met Newar people who do not like the connotation of being indigenous, because they often associate it with being primitive or backward or living in forest. But again, I think it's also a lack of understanding on their part, because indigenous peoples in the law, in international law in particular, as well as in Nepal's law, is basically a group of people who have distinct rights, or like who have traditional domain, historical continuity over their lands, distinctness in terms of language. So it does not necessarily should be connected to primitiveness, but that is how it has been traditionally expounded and understood. So yeah, the wellness of socioeconomic indicators have often made it difficult to bring along that indigenous consciousness too, particularly in terms of rights, in terms of understanding of rights. But having good socioeconomic indicators among Newar people has also made it easier in many ways to bring along the social indigenous in consciousness, particularly because we have had these access to these socioeconomic services, including, access to education, access to communication technologies, information and communication technologies that has made it easier to flow the information. No, the main challenge that I face in indigenous activism among Newar people is that being an urbanized indigenous group, it is often difficult for communities to make time to assert their indigenous rights unless their homes and lands are directly affected. Yeah. So a significant wave of indigenous consciousness among Newar people came about when government started implementing this Kathmandu Valley Road Improvement Project that was basically going to displace, 150,000 households along various urban lands of Nepal in the name of road expansion. And that also without compensation to the houses, the house owners. They were living there since long before the government introduced this law, because a significant proportion of those house owners were Newar, even more than 90%, I would say. That brought along a big number of affected people who started being conscious about indigenous rights and how the Nepal's laws are not in line with indigenous rights. No? Similarly, as we have already discussed, the communities in Kokana and Bungamati are now having this consciousness about indigenous rights in response to these destructive development projects that are being proposed in their area. The same goes for the Chobar communities in Chobar. We believe that the government is acting similarly to a realtor, as we call them, Jagadalals or land mafias in Nepal. And what we also believe is Kathmandu as a small valley, which is basically 0.6% of the total land area of Nepal, cannot hold any more urbanization, planned or unplanned, because it's already 10 to 15% of population of Nepal that are already living in Kathmandu. And with finite resources that are in Kathmandu, we are already facing shortage of water, severe air pollution. There is traffic problem. There is the issue about a lack of open spaces. So I think the indigenous consciousness in among Newar people is basically coming in this way in response to these destructive development projects that the government is proposing or planning in their communities.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I can see that as someone who lives in Kathmandu Valley and not being a landowner, but living under the conditions, right? Like you said, the air quality is certainly getting worse over the years. Water is a problem for so many people. And then on top of it, you put these projects. So I can see how people who have lived here for generations are just feeling like, this is going too far. How much can we put up with? So that's, I think, a good snapshot of what's happening in Kathmandu Valley and how indigenous inhabitants are reacting. So to back up a little bit and to take a broader view of Nepal as a whole, I first came near the end of the Maoist war, the Maoist uprising which occurred from 1996 to 2006. And there was a lot of focus then on indigenous rights and indigenous groups, because one of the things that the Maoists proposed was that organizing Nepal on a new federal system where the states would correspond to the geographic homes of various indigenous groups. So in fact, Kathmandu Valley would, I forget the name that the Maoists were suggesting for it, you might know, but that would be basically correspond to the Newar homeland. Mm-hmm. And other parts of the country would correspond to the homelands of other indigenous groups. So there was certainly a lot of talk then about this proposal, both positive and negative. But then it seems to me after that, talk about indigenous rights has really, really declined. And I'm wondering what you think. I mean, is that your opinion, number one? But if you agree that we're hearing less and less talk in general about indigenous rights and indigenous activism, do you think that people were discouraged after the country was reorganize, but not along the lines that the Maoists had suggested. Or maybe things are just happening at a level where people like me don't hear about them. They're underground, or they're happening in different venue, maybe internationally, the way you're doing some of your work.
Yes, Marty, I think it's the latter, or that's how it's going on right now. As I said, you know, the indigenous movement in Nepal has its roots in various ethnic rebellion that have occurred at different times of history, which have been well documented in a book by Mahendra Lawati and other scholars too. For Newar people, again, it started as a language movement, but the problem back then was, you know, not the problem back then, but I think it's also a continuing problem, is that it wasn't all happening at a national level. You know, it was happening at local levels, or let's say at sub-national levels, no? For sure, the indigenous movement in Nepal picked its peak since the democratic opening, and picked its highest peak after the Maoist, I would say, cashed in on the grievances of various indigenous nationalities in Nepal. Yes, we are called indigenous nationalities as per the official national laws. The grievances or aspirations of indigenous communities for autonomy or self-governance were dear even before, you know, the Maoist, established those demands in the national political process. However, I mean, we should be grateful for the Maoist insurgency in some way, that it was established, or it was at least registered in the national political process. But then again, you know, they basically used these indigenous aspirations to get their space in the mainstream political process, and then, you know, ignored these aspirations once they were in power, or maybe they could not take it on, also because of the loss of political constituency. What I think is, it's not that indigenous rights movement have lost its theme. It is still happening. There are various political groups and also indigenous-led political groups that are continuing its agenda. The fourth, now it's, I think, the fifth largest party, has been pushing for identity-based federalism. So this identity-based federalism was misinterpreted by the mainstream political parties as ethnic federalism. What we as indigenous rights activists understand is, indigenous peoples have the right to self-determination, and by virtue of which we, indigenous communities, indigenous peoples are able to freely determine our political status, as well as, you know, pursue our socioeconomic and cultural development. Indigenous peoples, to exercise their right to self-determination, have the right to self-governance and autonomy in our local affairs, and also how to mobilize resources for exercising such autonomy and self-governance. No, and I'm not making it up. It's provided in international law. I basically just read out two articles 3 and 4 of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And as I said earlier, Nepal has signed on to that declaration, no? And so that is basically applicable to Nepal, and Nepal is morally, and I would say even legally, obliged to implement that declaration and to implement the right of indigenous communities to self-determination. And in the political context of 2006-2007, when Maoist insurgency ended, there was the peace process that was set up, as well as the process for a new constitution building. The new federal structure, the proposed federal structure was considered as a means to implement this right to self-determination. But again, as I said, the status quo is political forces that are dominated by the dominant groups and elites, misinterpreted this right to self-determination and the new federal structure that was proposed as a means to implement that right to self-determination. But coming back to the indigenous movement, yes, since the formulation or finalization, promulgation of the new constitution, the issue of identity-based federalism has been pushed to a back burner. I think it was also a matter of the context back then when the constitution was promulgated. Nepal has just come out of a devastating earthquake, not just one, but two. And then, you know, also the time when there was this so-called blockade by India that crippled life of the general population, you know, in terms of fuel and other necessary products. So yeah, I mean, that was the context back then when the constitution was promulgated. Also, that came at the cost of many lives, particularly in the south of Nepal, of the Madeshi protesters who wanted more meaningful federalism as well as, you know, inclusive governance system in the new constitution. I think the province too did get some of the demands as per the aspirations of the Madeshi movement. But then the indigenous movement was very politically divided. The indigenous leaders, or the indigenous political leaders, I would say, you know, were divided among various political parties, and we could not push the political heads, basically the four people who decided on the final constitution, all Brahmin male, to come along on our aspirations. While the discourse on federalism as a means to means for indigenous people to exercise our right to self-determination have lost its theme, I would say many indigenous communities at the local or sub-national levels are still trying to exercise their right to self-determination through existing legal provisions. An example is the recent setup of culturally protected area in Kirtipur. In Nepal, it's called Kirtipur Sanskritik Samrakshit Kshetra. The Kirtipur municipality has adopted this law to set up Kirtipur culturally protected area, whereby the law refers to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and the ILO Convention 169, and provides for a formation of a council of Guti representatives, that are existing in Kirtipur, no, as a means for some form of cultural autonomy within the Kirtipur municipal area. Yeah, Maji people that I'm working with in eastern Nepal have also been demanding Maji autonomous area in Ramechhap district. And such demands have particularly come in the context of their opposition to many hydropower projects that are being built or proposed in the Sunkoshi River. The Maji, as the name translates, fisher folks, have very close association relationship with the river. Similarly, Baram people in Gorkha district have won a case in Supreme Court that has ordered three local governments in Gorkha district to address the aspiration of the Baram people for a special or protected area within those three local government jurisdiction, in line with the constitutional provision. No, so the discourse or the movement for indigenous or identity based federalism in the new federal structure of Nepal has lost steam in the national discourse, but there are these local processes that are happening. No, the Tharu people have also been able to get recognition for their traditional governance system called Budgar in many local governments in western Nepal through local laws. Yeah. And I would also say, like, you know, these demands or these movements for, let's say, special or protected areas are only one aspect of indigenous movement that is happening right now. As I said earlier, political activism is always there, but there is also cultural activism and land and resource rights activism that are happening all along. And, putting all of these activism together will give you the full picture of indigenous movement in Nepal.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I don't think I've heard about this action in Kirtipur. I'm assuming that the municipality is kind of led by Newar people, and that helped bring it about. But still, it's very interesting that they're using the UN Declaration to make that assertion about their culture. I really want to find out more about that.
That's only one of the many examples. In Lakhan municipality, I forget which district it is in, but in Lakhan Thapa municipality, the municipality has even adopted a law, a forest law, whereby they have now designated indigenous forests. Yeah, the national law of Nepal does not recognize indigenous forests. It only recognizes state forests. And, you know, within state forests, there can be community forests, whereby community is provided some management or user rights. No. So yeah, these things are happening. Hopefully someday, these let's say ground up autonomy movements will basically reignite the national autonomy discourse that was there when we were discussing the federal the new federal structure.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like it could turn out to be much more productive than the other way around. It's a bit like the tortoise and the hare, right? I mean, you know, the hare takes off all these great ideas about federalism and what we're going to do for you. But in the end, it's the tortoise who's like busy, you know, slowly doing things at the local level who actually has some results. So maybe that's the way it's going to work out. Listen, thank you again for explaining all of this. It's really interesting. I know that, you know, as you pointed out, about a third of Nepal's population is indigenous. There are many groups, at least 60 now recognized. And so we could be talking about these issues for a long time, but I think that was a good way to get into the topic of indigenous rights and activism in Nepal through the lens of what's happening, some of what's happening with the Nuer community in Kathmandu.
Thank you, Marty, for having me. Often there is not much, let's say, media or press coverage on indigenous issues in Nepal, as particularly when it comes to indigenous communities, you know, asserting their rights at the local level. So it helps a lot. Thank you for having me, and I hope I was able to give the responses that you were looking for.
Thanks again to Praveen Shakya for chatting with me today. If you like what you heard, make sure that you like, follow, or favorite Nepal Now on your podcast app. If you're a big fan of our work, leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. That will make it easier for others to find the show. I'm Marty Logan. I produced this episode, and I'll talk to you again soon.